Good morning and Happy New Year, Long Po. For today, we'll be proceeding with the Dharma talk and Q&A as well by Long Po. So with that, I would like to invite Brother Rennie to perform the formal request for the Dharma talk.
Long Paul, good morning.
Morning.
Jaloka Dipati Sahampati Katanjaliyan Adiwarang Ayachata Santi Dasata Paraja Kajatika Deise Tudaman Anukam Pimam Paja.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Happy New Year to you all. One of the we're starting our new year with a meditation retreat, and that is that's extremely skillful say one most people in the world do not begin their new year collecting themselves, meditating, reflecting on the reflecting on the Dhamma. It's usually things that scatter them and create more confusion in their life. So I think it's something to really delight in, taking the opportunity to begin the new year with a meditation retreat and 3 full days to begin the new year. Because oftentimes how we begin something tends to condition the direction that it goes in, so just whenever there are various sort of beginnings and endeavors that we embark on, really starting in a clear and skillful way is just really helpful. And so that beginning our year with a meditation retreat is just very worthy of praise. Something that comes to mind is when we think of a meditation retreat or practicing meditation, in our life, or you know, developing our Buddhist practice, we tend to think of meditation. We tend to think of the different techniques and our successes and failures in how we in our meditation, and remember Ajahn Chah, who, you know, of course he was a great meditation master. He was somebody who taught meditation to the monastic community, the lay community. He himself was very adept. But if you look at the bulk of his teachings, there's a much more of an importance or predominance of his teachings are around two themes, sila and sammaditti. That's that virtue and right view. And I think that's really important. It's very, like to take note of that, because so often we try, you know, what's wrong with my meditation technique? What's wrong with my mind? My mind's all over the place. Forget that there's roots that need to be nurtured, it's much more useful to sometimes backtrack and see what can we do to reestablish our connection with our sila, our virtue, and what kind of view am I holding, and what ways can I be adjusting view to be supportive for my practice, and oftentimes the meditation flows out of that, everything has a root, so that to be able to nourish the roots really skillfully. There's a discourse in the it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, and it has the same theme, where a monk comes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha for instructions so that he can go off and practice and be diligent. And curiously enough, the Buddha actually, he admonishes him, speaks to him pretty sharply, saying, you know, what is this? And, you know, people coming and asking questions and don't bother to follow up on the practice. And then the monk kind of reiterates and says, yeah, please, may I have some instruction in brief so that I can go off and practice. And then the Buddha agrees to teach, and he says to purify the very starting point of wholesome states, and how to purify the very starting point of wholesome states is to purify virtue and to make one's views straight, in that sense of aligning the views with sammāditti, with right view. So and in a sense, once one has having purified sila, made one's views straight, with that foundation of that one has established, then to direct one's attention to the four foundations of mindfulness. So that is it's a very interesting instruction, and that where the Buddha is placing that emphasis on coming back and purifying the very starting point of wholesome states, because when we direct our attention to mindfulness and to meditation, then if that kind of root or that foundation of wholesome mental qualities is there, wholesome states of mind, then the meditation is going to go a lot more smoothly. It's going to be much more accessible to us. And that so that sense of purifying virtue, I think one of the aspects of purifying virtue is not so much the getting the legal description of the precept, and then seeing how much one has to do and how much one can get away with. It's more that sense of approaching the precepts from a place one is the aspect of in Buddhist practice. There's a quality called hiri and otapa, and these are called the protectors of the world, and that these protectors of the world, they're kind of difficult to translate into English, because there's the hiri is like a good translation of his conscience, but it's sometimes kind of a sense of shame, or shrinking back from the unwholesome, and but it's important to recognize, because sometimes that gets shame, guilt, and that is that makes it very complicated. But the root of that sense of conscience is a respect for oneself, so that in that sense of when one either contemplating to do something or when one has done something that is unskillful, and it elicits a sense of, gosh, that wasn't really, I can do a lot better than that. And one wants to protect oneself from one's own unskillfulness, and one wants to. So there's this sense of respect for oneself that one is really directing attention to. This sense of protection, of looking after oneself, so that one is able to really nurture the qualities that uplift the mind and brighten the heart, and that so that's hiri. And otapa is a sense of, oftentimes translated as like a fear of wrongdoing. And again, that sense of, okay, sort of like goes into that shame and fear. But it's a fear of wrongdoing in the sense of because of respect for others. So that hiri and otapa are based in respect. So respect for oneself, respect for others. And so that one holds oneself and holds others dear. So then one doesn't want to harm or create suffering for others. So that our, say, our virtue or our integrity, our sila, has this root. So then when it has this root, it just keeps bringing, say, more and more wholesome mental states, because it's based on a wise understanding of that our actions have results, that both for ourselves and for others, so that when our actions have results, we want to make sure those results are ones that we can delight in, and that create a sense of well-being and harmony with those around us. So that sense of purifying virtue. And it's also in the sense of sila and in respect to our precepts. Understanding that precepts are, from a Buddhist perspective, are training rules. And training is so we're learning, we're educating ourselves, and it's not just sort of beating ourselves into submission somehow, but it's just a learning process, so that they, like when we took the precepts, the Pali for the word precept is sikha padang. And so that word sikha padang is a mixture of two words, pada, which means foot or base, sikha, which is to learn, to study, to train, to educate, and because certainly from in the Buddha's time, much education was in actual sort of hands-on engagement. It's not sort of sitting down with a book and memorizing something, but learning through our conduct. So the sense of training and learning is through doing, and so it's through our actions of body and speech that we're training, we're learning, we're educating ourselves. What works, what doesn't work, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial, what leads to well-being and happiness, what leads to complication and difficulty. And that's what precepts are. They're training rules that we gain skill at through our life, through living. And sometimes we get it right and sometimes we get it wrong, but we can learn from it. And that's what, say, that purifying virtue is the is that willingness to learn from our engagement with our actions of body, speech, and then obviously our mind is right there as well. So this is a learning process. So virtue is something that we're cultivating and developing because it does have a result, and that is the I'd say the foundation of right view, making our views straight, making our views align with say with samadhiti. Foundation of right view is say in the Pali, kamasakata ditti. So the sense of the being the owners of our actions, and as in the say like when we do the chant on the divine abidings for equanimity, it's kamasaka kamadayada kamayoni kamabantu kamapatisarana. I'm the owner of my action, heir to my action, born of my action, related to my actions, abide supported by my actions. So that sense of how we do, we do reap what we sow. And what we do has results. So that being attuned to that and being respectful of that, so that we're hardwired to prefer happiness and well-being to suffering and pain and difficulty. It's just is very much a part of our human nature, and we still do things that create suffering for ourselves. It's one of the curious aspects of human existence. We're good at we know something and then forget about it and then go ahead and do things that are to our detriment. But that's also what, say, the cultivation of wisdom and discernment is being able to have that clear knowledge and understanding, having that right view, so that we follow through with our actions and speech on the that sense of, okay, if I'm the heir to my actions, owner of my actions, then I really want to do that which brings happiness and well-being to myself and to others. And this fundamental, say, the very starting point of wholesome states. And that phrase I find very beautiful. And then recognizing that part of right view, when we say that we're the owners of our actions, heirs to our actions, it's also recognizing that we have a certain element of freedom to make choices and to make skillful choices. But, I mean, there is a view, part of, I've heard it expressed many times in Buddhist circles, sort of like everything is kamma, and your everything that you experience is the result of karma. And so that whatever you experience, it's because of something that you've done in your past. And that is an extreme view, which is not sammāditti. It's not right view. It's a view, but it's not a right view. Because the Buddha himself has said there are and just the aspects of nature. We inhabit a natural world. We inhabit a human body, and we're affected by all of it. In Buddhist teachings, there are different natural laws that affect us. Kind of inorganic laws of science, in the sense of an uttu niyama. Uttu is sort of like weather, but it's sort of external, inorganic, so things like I can remember years ago, it's actually 16 years ago around this time, there's big tsunami that took place in Southeast Asia and affected South Asia, and then people sort of say, well, it's karma, this is, and well, no, I mean, it's tectonic plates, it's science, and it's the way, these are natural laws, that's the way the natural world works, these are laws that govern us. Utu niyama, bija niyama is like law, organic natural laws can be, say, just the and bija is like seed or so aspects of the way plants and nature works. One could even say genetics and be a part of a bija niyama, so these are organic laws of nature, and they affect us. We're conditioned in different ways. Jitta niyama, just the way the mind responds to circumstances, and it can be in a beneficial way, can be not beneficial, but the mind has a role to play. Kamma niyama is your fourth law, and the last one is dhamma niyama, which is kind of a catch-all, really, and ends up being more like social, how things integrate and play together and create social dynamics. So all these different dynamics are affecting us. Karma is one of them. But what we do definitely has a response, has a result. And if you respond to somebody with anger and aversion, you'll probably get a negative response back. If you respond with kindness and patience, so you that you tend to get that same response back. I mean, it's a, and that's how we feel it as well. Internally, it resonates in a different way. So that these, like the very starting point of wholesome states, we have a role to play. And that's the Buddha points to like the, root defilements, greed, hatred, delusion. These are going to create problems. Or say like the when the Buddha points to the cause of suffering, it's a pointing to tanha, and tanha as desire, as thirst, but tanha is always desire that is tainted with greed, hatred, delusion. It always ends up in a place of suffering, of complication. It always ends up unsatisfactory. And of course, say like we translate tanha into English as desire, but then it's actually important to recognize that, say, tanha as a cause of suffering is a technical term, because it is desire that has greed, hatred, delusion. It's always going to end in suffering. Whereas we have different kinds of desires. Say like in English, you have the desire to do good. You have the desire to meditate and start the new year with practicing Dhamma. That's incredibly wholesome. That's a great desire. That's a really wholesome desire. But that wouldn't be called tanha in the scriptural language. That would be chanda. It's like desire that is, it can be wholesome. It can be, or motivation is maybe a good, it's more neutral term. So that recognizing that we have these different desires, we have, and we can be nurturing something that's good, because you can't just try to annihilate all forms of desire, all forms of, say, of action. Like I shouldn't be doing anything. That sense of like with right view, it isn't that everything that we, because if you start thinking like what we do has, I mean, it has results and has wholesome, it can have wholesome results, it can have unwholesome results. We need to do the work that allows us to establish clarity and wisdom and discernment, so that we can be making the choices that nurture well-being and skillfulness, happiness, peacefulness. And that's actually one of the just thinking in terms of the description of the peaceful mind, or description of, so say, of samadhi, when the mind settles, one of the words that the Buddha uses to describe the mind that is peaceful, is right samadhi, is kamaniya. It's ready for work, and this is the is ready to do what needs to be done, what's skillful, so that so being the owners of our actions is this sense of cultivating the the skillfulness that we can be developing our wisdom. So that as we purify our virtue, purify right view, then with that, this purifying the very starting point of wholesome states, with those wholesome states being the foundation, then we start directing attention to the four foundations of mindfulness and that sense of, okay, the foundations of mindfulness for view, in terms of the body, feelings, mind, objects of mind. These are just the basically body and mind, bringing attention. This is the ground that we're cultivating for our development is just this body and mind. It's not far away. It's not other. It's not some other realm somewhere else. But just in this very body, this very mind, and learning about it, studying it. Again, this is one of the basis of our Buddhist practice is the sikha training. So in the same way that precepts are a form of training, the whole path of cultivation is a training, is an education, is a learning. That's why I think when they say like a summary of the Noble Eightfold Path that the Buddha lays down, say Noble Eightfold Path leading to the end of suffering gets brought down into the what's called dry sikha, the three trainings in virtue, meditation, and wisdom. Those are things to train in. Those are things to cultivate. Those are things to develop. And pay attention, we can train ourselves. We can learn. That's the great beauty of a human birth is that we can actually learn. And that's one of the unfortunate births of lower realms or even in some of the higher realms where one is is not able to actually learn. So that we have this human birth and we can learn from our experience of happiness and suffering. We can learn from the things that we did right, learn from the things we did wrong, and we can learn how to be free. We can learn how to liberate the heart. That's incredible, incredible blessing. But it's that learning needs to be based on directing attention mindfully, so that the in the description of establishing mindfulness, and particularly that discourse that I was referring to, and the Buddha's saying that one having established those roots of wholesome states, then one directs one's attention to the four foundations of mindfulness in three ways, and that's internally, externally and both internally and externally. So that where each of those four foundations of mindfulness, how do we experience it internally? How do we pay attention to our own experience and learn from that? And then how do we pay attention to the world outside us and see how externally things play themselves out? And because that's we're not isolated beings, and we are inevitably connected to the world around us through our connections of either our family, our friends, our social situation. There's all these different layers of connection, and they are, and we can learn from the external. It's like that sense of how the Buddha said, open aiko. We're seeing something external and bringing it into the heart, and we're learning from it, understanding it, cultivating a discernment. The, say, internally and externally is how do we integrate the two? How do we have a balance so that there's a recognition and understanding of the both our own internal processes, understanding the world around us, but then how do we integrate the two of them? And of course, that's the function of mindfulness. And the foundation or the base is always in terms of coming back to Four Noble Truths, because that's this, the Buddha is always, it comes up over and over and over again, I teach only two things, dukkha and cessation of dukkha, suffering, ending of suffering. Sort of dissatisfaction and the ending of dissatisfaction, stress and the ending of stress. I mean, all of that, those, however one translates it. But just recognize, okay, there are these different, we need to be paying attention to ourselves. We need to be paying attention to the world around us. And then we have to be integrating those two so that there's there's an evenness or a smoothness. It's like, it's not just about being mindful for oneself. If I'm just mindful, I keep my head down and just be mindful, then it's all going to work out. No, you have to pay attention to the world around. It's like one of the epithets when we do the chanting and recollect the Buddha, one of the qualities of the Buddha is vijja jarana sampanno, and that he's, say, perfect in knowledge and conduct. So that the two working together, the internal knowledge, the external expression, and then the understanding of those two. So that sense of cultivating a clear understanding. Okay, what are these four foundations of mindfulness for, and what is mindfulness anyway? I mean, that's, and I think, especially in these days, there's a lot of kind of complication or expressions of mindfulness. I think it's helpful. Whenever the Buddha talks about mindfulness, he always talks about it with four particular qualities. In the Pali, Atapi Sampajano Satima Vinaya Loke Apichato Manasa, so that Atapi is ardent. There's some effort there. It's not passive, just vegging out mindfulness. There's some application. One needs to put forth a bit of effort. But again, even when we think of right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's always about wholesome and unwholesome mental states. It's not necessarily about what we're, say, how spectacular it looks outside, but it's or how energetic it appears, or how much flailing around one does. It's about the quality of the heart. So that increasing wholesome qualities, decreasing the unwholesome qualities. That's the purpose of right effort. So atapi is application of being ardent. Sampajano is clearly comprehending, having a and then that's also the part of clear comprehension is that sense of how our actions, a body, speech, and mind affect ourselves and affect others. That clear comprehension. Seeing that how that plays itself out. Satima is possessed of mindfulness, being aware, being alert, being present. And then the last quality is vinaya loke abhichato manasa, sort of like the pulling back from the habit of liking and disliking, wanting, not wanting, approving, not approving, that we bounce around with those that's our likes and our dislikes, that sense of should be, shouldn't be, and we keep spinning with that, so that mindfulness is able to have that balance of just not being pulled into that willingness to relinquish or let go the positions that we tend to take, because we tend to invest in our positions and like, dislike, right, wrong, good, bad, and we take a stand on them, and we tend to suffer accordingly, and usually share it out as well. So it's a sense of having a balance and seeking a balance, so that this cultivation of our practice, purifying the very starting point of wholesome states, putting our attention on these four foundations of mindfulness, and the Buddha said that if one does that, then what one will reap is more. One will reap only that which is wholesome and skillful. That's the fruit. That's the result. Anyway, in the discourse itself, then of course, as these discourses go, the monk took the teaching that he received and went off, practiced, and realized awakening. And these are. So it's a teaching for all of us, and recognizing that there is a there's foundations that we need to build, and then our practices that we need to be cultivating. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning.
Annamaya namakataya sadukaram dadamase sadu 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 anumodami.
Okay, so the next part of this session is just answer some questions. It looks like people have been very diligent writing in questions, and I doubt that I'll get through them all, but I'll try to get through some anyway, and there's a couple on meditation itself, which I might address. I find it very difficult to stay with the breath after 15 to 20 minutes, and the mind will be very bored with the breath and cannot stay with it. Could you advise what is a good meditation for an easily restless mind? This is so even after I practice meditation every morning for several years now. I think one of the things is how are we holding it in terms of how are we holding the meditation object, at whatever it is, whether it's the breath or Buddho or body contemplation or loving kindness, you know, whatever, or reflections on Nitya, Dukkha, Anatta. Those are all, how do you say, right meditation objects, but how do we hold it? Because we can be, if we have hold it in a way, is that okay? I have to pay attention. I've got to be mindful of my in breath, mindful of my out breath. I have to be mindful. Just that. That burden of having to watch the breath all the time, that's boring. I mean, but it's not so much that the breath is boring, it's our attitude that makes it burdensome. I have to do this. I've got to keep that breath in mind in order for me to be a successful meditator. And of course, if you don't do, the other side of that is if I don't, then I'm a failure. So it's a, but it's more like, how do we, it comes back to that quality of wholesome desire, chanda, that which also one of the ways I've translated it is as interest. Like how does one initiate and maintain an interest in the meditation object? How does one hold it in different ways, and then also having different options in terms of using the like paying attention to the breath, at different points, paying attention to the breath in terms of the actual, say, sensation, paying attention in terms of how we're experiencing it, paying attention in terms of integrating it with maybe a visualization of light, or accompanying it with Buddha, or anything else. So it's like being a little bit creative in saying, well, how can this be interesting? And how can I experience this? What are other feelings associated with the breath? So it's learning how to explore it rather than trying to conceive of what I should be doing and then trying to fulfill that. That gets tiresome after a while. One has to learn how to be a bit creative with working with the meditation and working with the breath. And certainly you think in terms of how did the Buddha teach mindfulness of breathing? I mean, there's 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. So it isn't just sort of sitting there watching the breath go in and out. There's all sorts of contemplations, investigations that are associated with the breath as a, say, as a basis or as a bit of a foundation. So that, just taking a bit of interest in the attitude that how we're holding, how we're conceiving of what we should be doing, and relax around that a bit and learn how to enjoy mindfulness of breathing. Enjoy the meditation, whatever meditation one's doing. That's a really important point of meditation practice is how does one hold it in a way that is conducive to enjoyment, to delight. Because there's a in the Buddha's teachings, there's a recurring there's a recurring sequence of states of mind as one develops the path, and some of it's in application to the meditation, some of it is through cultivation of virtue, some of it is through faith or devotion, but they all feed into a starting point or a point of what the Buddha calls delight, pamoja, and then with delight as a basis, and there's a arising of joy, of bhiti, and then with bhiti as a basis, there's the arising of pasati, of tranquility, and then with tranquility as a basis, arising of sukha, of happiness. And with happiness as a basis, there's a rising of samadhi. And in some of the suttas, the Buddha actually stops at that point and emphasizes the happy mind is easily settled, is easily concentrated. So the happy mind easily experiences samadhi. So that the sense of learning how to nurture the qualities of a wholesome happiness. So that's a part of our mindfulness training, mindfulness of breathing. How to do it so that it doesn't turn into a boring chore that one feels one has to do. That is sort of, oh, when one does the meditation, that one picks up an enthusiasm and kind of exploration. Oh, what am I going to learn today? And that's a whole different attitude. So then when the mind is kind of happy to stay with the breath. Okay, next question. Okay, the mind is scattered with it, wandering mind, any advice to settle down the mind? I'm currently practicing Bhutto. I think it's similar. Our minds get scattered because we're bored. We're looking for something else. So just becoming a bit creative in how to take an interest with the meditation. It's another question about Bhutto. Is it all right to do Bhutto recitation after my mind is calm on breath meditation? Okay. Well, I think one can be doing Bhutto at any time. It's just a tool, and it can be helpful. It can be a helpful tool on its own, just recitation. It's the name of the Buddha. It's very meaningful. The Buddha is, literally sort of one who is awake, one who knows. So it's a good reminder. What am I doing here? I'm trying to maintain this awake presence, being the one who knows. So it's a... something to one can use as a reflection. One can do it in conjunction with breath meditation, on the in breath put, on the out breath toe. If the mind is calm, the thing is does the mind say delight in it? Is it interested? And so that using the Bhutto, and also sometimes. When the mind becomes really calm, that Bhutto can be a good reminder to stay present, to stay the one, just a soft kind of background. It can also end up being extraneous, a distraction, because we practice meditation, we practice mindfulness in order to be awake, to be alert, to be the one who knows. And once that quality of knowing is there, say just putting in Bhutto can be a disturbance as well. So you have to, you have to pay attention to what your mind is doing, what the state of mind is, and what is actually working, what is helpful, what is beneficial. And it's helpful to have a few tools that you use at different times for that supporting the ongoing cultivation of clarity, understanding, peace, well-being. Those are because sometimes just being present is enough. Just being awake, being the one who knows is enough. Not And then sometimes it needs support to keep get some kind of definition to what the mind is doing. Because sometimes we can sit there being the one who knows and then space out. It's not defined enough. So clarifying the breath, and so this, you're working with the mind. That is meditation. You're working with the mind. You're working with the heart. Okay. I'll go there. I'll go to a few different places. There's one from how to overcome anxiety. How always to be with Dhamma in the heart. I think one of the things with anxiety is is to this sense of, I mean, there's this loving kindness is a really important quality that counters anxiety. Compassion as anxiety is suffering. So this sense of compassionate response to anxiety. It's also a sense of because sometimes just a sense of generosity and giving, because sometimes like anxiety tends to sort of close and collapse, so then something like a generosity, a sense of giving, a sense of sharing, a sense of openness, those tend to expand that contraction around fear and anxiety. Another aspect of anxiety is just the how the mind, how the heart responds to uncertainty, and of course, uncertainty is the very nature of our existence, anybody's existence, all of existence. It all is very uncertain. This is a corollary of they say one of the universal truths that the Buddha points to, universal characteristics is anicca, impermanence. And impermanence in the sense of inconstancy, change, but Ajahn Chah used to express anicca sometimes as uncertain, unsure, which I thought was really skillful, because when we think of impermanence, change, inconstancy, then just the habit of mind is that it tends to be, how do you say, projected outwards, it's sort of, or externalized or objectified. Like there is an objectified reality out there that is impermanent and changing. But how we experience it is, so internally in the heart is, well, this is unsure, this is uncertain. All this change is really not, I'm not sure what's going on. So then anxiety is can be a part of that. So that just that recognition of change and impermanence and uncertainty is how things actually are. It's always been like this. And then bringing, say, like fear is, it proliferates when things aren't seen clearly. So that the more we're able to bring awareness and mindfulness and clarity and a kind of spacious knowing to things, then it clears out the space where fear and anxiety tends to lurk and proliferate. So just that bringing the cultivation of mindfulness and awareness in itself is a great antidote to anxiety. So that things like loving kindness, generosity, compassion, these are all, you know, they're all great counterpoints and it's the ongoing, and even say a bit more fundamental, is that just in the talk that I gave of the purifying the very starting point of wholesome states, just the nature of wholesome qualities of mind are that they will tend to counter, say, anxiety, fear. There's just that sense of the wholesome, skillful, bright states of well-being in and of themselves are a counterpoint to, say, to anxiety, to fear. There's a question on how to get rid of judgmental, critical thoughts about others. Well, I think one is even just sort of looking at the even the question of to get rid of judgmental, critical thoughts about others, one's already recognizing. So one's trying to, I need to get rid of, so I need to annihilate those critical thoughts of others, because I'm such a critical person, and so I think one of the things is to be able to recognize that the criticism of others and the judgments of others, you know, comes from a kind of dissatisfaction within ourselves. When we're unhappy, when we're critical of ourselves, we tend to sort of project it out, and so that, and then if we respond with kind of getting rid of, annihilating, stamping it out, that in itself is pretty negative, and is going to keep the ball rolling. That conscious cultivation of loving kindness, that sense of really wishing oneself and others well-being, happiness, to be to be very conscious of that wish for well-being and that wish to alleviate suffering in oneself, alleviate suffering in others, really nurturing that kind of skillful quality of of loving kindness and compassion, then the tendency to say critical judgmentalism, judging oneself, judging others, it tends to be dissolved and drops away because it doesn't have the same root anymore. So that I think that's a we will tire ourselves out trying to stamp out all of the the negativity. It's like where the teachers, and like if we spend all our time trying to, like in the forest or a vine will grow up and it'll spread all through different trees in the forest, and it'll weigh it down, and they'll be very parasitic and negative to the trees. And if we spend all our time clipping the ends of the vines that are spreading here, spreading there, we can tire ourselves out and never really come to an end of it. But if we trace that vine and figure out, okay, there's where it's growing from, you come back to its root, then you just cut that. And it's done. So it's that. So that's in working with our own defilements, being recognizing that all these different expressions of suffering they've got a root, and being able to understand that and cultivate the wholesome roots of skillfulness and cultivation of our well-being. So it is 6:30, and that's the end of our Q&A session. So we'll close for those people in Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. It's late evening, so just wish you all a good night. For those of us in other parts of the planet, certainly in America, then we're beginning our day. So hopefully we'll begin our day with mindfulness, purification of sila and right view and four foundations of mindfulness, and begin our day. So just we will see you later.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.